to Simon Evans Goes to Market. Hello and welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market, Radio 4's only economics comedy hybrid. Imagine the body of BBC economics editor Kamal Ahmed with the head of Bobby Davro, trapped in a comedy club which is being used to host an edition of Moneybox Live. So far this series, we've covered tax avoidance by multinationals and the rise of social media companies. So this week, we turn our attention to the perhaps less obvious evil of philanthropy. The greatest pleasure I know, said essayist Charles Lamb, is to do a good action by stealth and have it found out by accident. Also, writing on the sole of a slipper with a biro. He didn't really say that one. Charles Lamb died the day after Boxing Day in 1834, possibly from a surfeit of pleasure after all the secret Santas in his office were traced back to his stealthy generosity. A few years previously, the first great wave of institutionalised philanthropy had done away with the stealth part and transformed expectations of how wealth behaves in Western society. Philanthropy today is a significant economic force in our world, yet one which escapes the level of scrutiny to which even my most trivial donations to Ladbrokes are generally subject. It's time to take a long, hard squint at these so-called do-gooders and see what they're really up to. To lend academic authority to my sceptical facial distortions, I am joined as ever by our caged economist, a man who philanthropically turns up every week entirely without recompense. What's in it for him, I wonder? Please welcome Tim Harford. So, Tim, how are you doing? Are you feeling charitable this
evening? Absolutely. I've got a tin bath ready and a few hundred tins of beans. This donkey sanctuary isn't going to save itself.
Well, that's awfully good of you, Tim, and I can see you're using the baked beans with the little sausages in them. I really hope that's what that is, but... Despite the unimpeachable good intentions of the sponsored baked bean bath, big philanthropy has moved on of late, and we are going to try and catch it up. Philanthropy nowadays is quite literally big business, right?
Yes, total US charitable spending in 2016 was $390 billion, which is quite a lot of money. Here in the UK, around one in five of the people on the Sunday Times Rich List have donated at least £1 million to charity in the past year. And charitable giving continues to grow. So in the US, over the past four decades, organised philanthropy has grown about four times over, both in terms of the number of foundations and the size of the total grants. Philanthropy in the US dwarfs the entire government budgets of many smaller countries.
Which puts the 40 pence I spent on a Rice Krispie cluster at the school bake sale into perspective. Though eating food made by the norovirus-caked hands of a six-year-old is actually as good a crash diet as any. Thank you, Tim. We're also joined, as ever, by our resident expert on big data. Big data, I should say, is not like a plus-size Tinder app. It is, instead, a study of how information gathering is changing our world. But perhaps you'll know why I keep getting emails from Saga. Please welcome Timandra Harkness.
Thank you.
We are going to be talking later about how charities might use data about you to target you with campaigns that you will be particularly positively disposed to, though. Seriously, that's right, yes?
That's right. It sounds horrible, doesn't it?
It does. The concept of that, yes, not talking to you about it, obviously, no. But, well, listen, we will speak later. Tim, let's get to the fundamentals of what's going on psychologically. What do economists make of giving money away? It's not economically rational, is it? You lot are usually much more about keeping money, judging by how little Robert Peston, for instance, spends on haircuts.
Yeah. The traditional economic view of charity, I mean, we economists have tended to be a bit incurious about it. Economists would say, well, people like all sorts of things. Some people like Stilton. Some people like skiing. Some people like performing acts of philanthropy. De gustibus non est disputandum. There's no accounting for taste. I mean, economists have started to develop this idea that pure altruism is at the heart of charitable giving. But in Darwinian terms, that would be odd. I mean, no other animals do altruistic things like give money or give blood or give their children the idea they can paint. I mean, this is a uniquely human behaviour. Fridge doors in the wild are notoriously free of crap school art projects. But There's a second theory that economists have as to why people give, and that is the warm glow theory. And the warm glow theory is that we do stuff that makes us all feel, you know, warm and fuzzy inside, like giving change to rough sleepers. It's like drinking cognac, but without the hangover or the trade deficit. We don't really ask too many questions about whether either the cognac or the spare change is doing any long-term good. But the most interesting theory I've seen is that when I give to charity, I have an ulterior motive.
Am I right in thinking that, like everything else, it might be about sex? Is that the usual economist's explanation? Ultimately, it's either sex or scarce resources, which certainly sums up my life choices.
There's a theory concerning sexual selection. Darwin was intrigued by the peacock's tail. I mean, it's big, it's cumbersome, it shows predators where you are. It's not obviously advantageous. However, the tail clearly helps the peacock attract mates. And it's been suggested that maybe charitable largesse could operate in the same way. It certainly suggests that money isn't an issue, right? And men in the early stages of relationships have been shown to give to beggars more frequently than once they're in long-term committed relationships.
By which point they've started eyeing men sitting alone on the pavement with something approaching envy, in fact.
By which time their partners are trapped and, you know, you don't have to impress them anymore. Anyway, it definitely doesn't seem to arise from a genuine concern for the cause.
Generous though they often are, the British public are outmaneuvered nowadays by a handful of unimaginably wealthy and ambitious philanthrocapitalists who are using their muscle to engineer change in a lot more than the prevailing mood of retired donkeys. Big philanthropy first emerged in America in the early 20th century as the infamous robber barons of the American Industrial Revolution sought to improve their reputations with man and God. Andrew Carnegie, the steel magnate who famously said that he who dies rich dies disgraced, was so determined to redistribute his profits into the welfare of the poor through libraries, concert halls and the morally improving like that he ruthlessly broke strikes and drove down the wages of his workers almost to starvation level in order to accumulate more wealth with which to do so. He thus not only had more money to help the poor, he had more poor to help with it. Win-win. Pretty clever, right, Tim?
Well, sort of. Although, despite trying to appear as wonderful and selfless, these guys weren't a hit with everyone. When John D. Rockefeller tried to establish a philanthropic foundation in his name, future President Theodore Roosevelt said that no amount of charity in spending such fortunes can compensate in any way for the misconduct in acquiring them.
In fact, Mr. Rockefeller got his foundation, and it has made many notable and worthy contributions to promoting the well-being of humanity throughout the world, as per its mission statement. But it is perhaps worth mentioning that it also knowingly funded racial studies in Nazi Germany, the very studies that were, of course, later used to justify persecution of the Jews throughout the 1930s and in World War II. Still easy to judge with the benefit of hindsight. The key point is that good intentions, however legitimately well-funded, can be disastrously misguided, especially when not subject to the scrutiny of democratic and adversarial debate. It's a bit like when your partner buys you a birthday present without asking you what you actually want. Sometimes it's a lovely surprise, and sometimes you have to pretend that you're happy going to work wearing a cape. Thank you, darling. Effective or not, a key common denominator with these first philanthropic foundations was that they were attempting to direct funds towards the root cause of problems rather than temporary quick fixes. Is that right, Tim?
Yeah, that's right. That's the heart of what modern philanthropy is. And parallels have been drawn between these early foundations' view of social problems and the ideas which were emerging at the time in modern medicine, particularly germ theory. So germs were a new idea back then. The idea that you could not merely alleviate the symptoms, but you could discover the true nature, the cause of a disease. It was very exciting. And private philanthropies planned to do the same thing for social ills, such as poverty and illiteracy. You sponsor research on a problem, you finance the design of a remedy, and you pay for implementation.
So this is basically the difference between charity, which is like a band-aid, and philanthropy, which is stopping Bob Geldof from singing altogether.
As they say, give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. Set up a foundation that targets research funding into holistic piscatorial harvesting strategies, and you can really impact long-term outcomes.
The thing is, while germ theory is very useful for thinking about illnesses, there is an argument to say it might not be so useful for thinking about social problems. If you think about measles, that is caused by one thing, the measles virus. But social ills, like illiteracy or poverty or leggings, for example... caused by any number of things, not just one germ. Also, of course, the germ, in many instances, turns out to be someone else's best interests.
Exactly. And not only that, there's no check on philanthropists' power and influence. The super rich may act with good intentions, but in these scenarios, they decide what amounts to good. And they're only human, as subject to whims as the rest of us. Sometimes these whims are adorable, such as when Google billionaire Eric Schmidt's wife, Wendy, set up the Schmidt Ocean Institute in Palo Alto and bought a ship that, unlike most research vessels, has outdoor lounges with teak furniture, a sauna, and a helicopter pad. Quirky, but you know, no harm done. But in the field of medical research, for instance, the diseases that get rich people's money often seem to depend on what family trauma they have personally experienced.
One assumes largely skiing injuries, hauntings, and gout. To be fair, I'm still inclined to be okay with this. I give money to charities that I can see the point of. The Royal Society for the Prevention of Birds, for instance. But if I had the dosh, I think what I'd really like to see is some venerable institution named after me, a really high-end Turkish bath or something, perhaps.
Well, it's a very sound idea, Simon, and it could even be profitable. Back in 1973, a gentleman called Avery Fisher gave the Lincoln Center in New York $10 million to name the Symphony Hall after him. Nothing extraordinary about that, you might think. But then, a few years ago, the Lincoln Center figured they could get a better deal from a new donor. So what they did is they went back to Avery Fisher's family and they agreed to pay them $15 million for the right to take his name off the concert hall, which is quite something because not only did Avery Fisher get his name prominently displayed in New York for four decades, his family got all the money back plus interest. Not a lot of interest, it must be said, but better than you can get in a cash ISA. This could be a new asset class.
So what is the building called now?
Well, $100 million later, it's called the David Geffen Hall, named to match the David Geffen School of Medicine, the Geffen Playhouse, and the imaginatively titled David Geffen Building.
Wonder what goes on in there.
All this raises a question. Should that $100 million given by David Geffen be written off against tax? He's getting something in return, namely massive self-glorification. I mean, ego aside, naming buildings after you is a business plan in itself. It can get you into the White House. And you may later get your money back. With interest, might be a better investment than shares or bonds.
Setting aside the secret billionaires who blithely give their money away without us even noticing, what are the more questionable elements here?
Well, more problematic is marching into some complex field, say education, full of radical ideas, throwing some money around, making matters worse, then leaving the wreckage for the public sector to try and clear up. For example, Mark Zuckerberg encountered some trouble in Newark, New Jersey, when he shelled out millions on educational consultants to, quote, solve public schools. The whole business was accused by the New York Times of being downright chilling, with these consultants and their business school buzzwords everywhere. One critic described the entire project as a $200 million iceberg which slowly melted into a cold sea of recrimination. Now, the point is, however good your intention, you can't take control of education without taking control of education away from someone else. And in America, at least, the people you take it away from are often democratically elected and accountable.
Well, that sounds all too plausible. And this is it. We've reached it. This is the nub. Although this philanthropic sector is privately governed, it is a matter of national interest when their funds are not used effectively, because tax breaks on charitable giving from private foundations mean that the art of giving is publicly subsidised. To understand more about the relationship between philanthropy and the public purse, I spoke to Merin Somerset Webb, editor of Money Week, and I started by asking her to describe the tax situation of a charitable foundation.
Well, basically, a foundation is just another type of charity, of which we have a vast number in the UK. Something in the region of 170,000 separate charities is set up in the UK. So that's a huge amount of money inside this charitable sector. And the tax breaks that a charity gets are basically endless. So any money that is put into a charity or given to a charity immediately gets gift aid. So if you hand over 100 quid to a charity, they immediately can reclaim £25 from the Treasury. So that's 25 quid taken from the taxpayer in general and given directly to the charity. Yeah. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, you can then reclaim any other tax that you've paid inside your self-assessment form. So another 25 quid if you're a 40% taxpayer comes straight out of the Treasury back into your pocket. So the first thing to note is that this gift aid is extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And that every time you give money to a charity and you claim gift aid, you are removing money from the Treasury and effectively saying, I believe that the work of this charity is more important than the work of the state. So I value Donkeys or Red Squirrels or the Serpentine Gallery or whatever it is over schools, hospitals, UK defence, etc. That's what you're saying when you claim gift aid.
Well, it makes you think, doesn't it, about ticking that gift aid box next time Auntie Maud is collecting money for her bell-ringing group. You're literally tearing a textbook out of a child's hands. I asked Merriam whether she ever ticks the gift aid box.
I never take the gift aid box.
Interesting.
I believe it's a dereliction of my democratic duty.
Yeah.
In that, you know, I feel that as a democratic community, we've voted in governments, and whether we approve of everything they do or not, we have nonetheless abided by a social contract that says that we will pay the tax due in order for the state to provide the services that we have voted for it to provide.
Yeah.
And by ticking the gift aid box, what I do is I hypothecate my tax payments away from the core services of the state towards my particular whims. So why is it that someone extremely rich, for example, should be able to effectively say to the rest of the UK population, you know, I'm not that into paying for education for everybody. Instead, I would like to pay for my pet opera group. And this makes no real sense. It always says you can add an extra 25% at no cost to you. What it should say, you can add an extra 25% to your donation at a cost to society as a whole.
Mm. Feeling guilty yet? I hope so, you callous, unthinking, charity-donating bastards. I asked Merriam whether she is similarly down on tax relief for big foundations.
So, expanding, scaling that up, how do you then feel about the philanthrocapitalism, the big foundations, the Gates Foundation?
In exactly
Buffett's?
The same way. Yeah. If any of our very rich tech entrepreneurs or anyone else who has made a fortune doing anything entrepreneurial or capitalist, brilliant, marvellous, well done them, let them now do whatever they want to do next on their own ticket, not ours.
Yeah.
So I don't think that it makes sense for very large foundations to have this kind of tax relief. If we believe, which I think most of us do, that the core work of the state is important, we would like to pay for that first before we pay for the whims of our billionaires.
So there we have it, gift aid or government. Perhaps if they called tax govdaid, people would cough up a bit more eagerly. So should Mark Totally Human Zuckerberg really be deciding how his billions are best spent, or should that be left to the states in which his vast and ever-expanding services operate and from which they, shall we say, suck their revenues? Perhaps the best answer also depends on the degree to which philanthropists are becoming ever more overtly political, Tim.
Yes, this is becoming more and more of an issue. According to the author Pablo Eisenberg, foundations in general avoided politically controversial issues, and that changed quite recently. So Eisenberg says that the zeal and impatience of big donors, for example, the Koch brothers on the right, George Soros on the left, that's changed the game. Now, in the UK, George Soros is probably better known than the Koch brothers, though more for betting against Norman Lamont's ability to keep the pound in the ERM, perhaps, than for his good works. But Soros is strongly in favour of liberal democracy in general, however, and freedom of movement into and in the European Union in particular. And he's donated $18 billion to his Open Society Foundation to pursue these and other aims.
See, now, some people will hear that and want to scoop George up in their arms and give him a big cuddle. Others, perhaps as many as 52% of the UK population, will feel their brows narrowing slightly at the influence this American citizen has on European politics.
Yeah, it's certainly controversial. His own biographer has identified George Soros as perhaps the only private citizen in the world with both his own foreign policy and the means to implement it. I mean, in fairness, a lot of people like what he's doing, but let's be honest, he's basically an airline and a national anthem away from being his own country. And who would you want on your side, a multi-billionaire with money to burn or Vanuatu? I mean, we should all be thinking about this.
So, Tim, we've spent the best part of half an hour focusing on the unintended negative economic consequences of philanthropy. What about the positives? At the end of the day, these people are being very generous. The Gates Foundation spends $5 billion a year on health issues, which is slightly more than the World Health Organization. I don't know what I'd do with my money if I had hundreds of billions. I like to think I'd give some away, but there's every chance I'd blow it all on eBay. Are there any actual advantages to private spending over government spending? There's a suggestion that philanthropists are less risk-averse.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, problem-solving often involves some risk. There's going to be trial and error involved. And Governments, for understandable reasons, can be risk-averse. They try and solve social problems, but they don't want to take a punt with public money because, well, it'd be embarrassing if some bold new idea didn't pan out. Philanthropists are in a different position. They're loaded. They're trying to change the world. They can afford to try some long shots, ideas that might flop.
Surely, in the modern world, it should be possible to harness ever more accurate feedback data to make sure your good works are having the right effects. Which means it's time to activate the data klaxon, and please welcome our resident big data expert, Tamandra Harkness. So, Tamandra, big data. How is big data affecting philanthropy?
If you want to start with how it's affecting charitable giving, then charities tend to use data similar way to other people who are advertising stuff to us. So, for example, if you see a poster with a picture of a little puppy and your heart breaks and you text puppy to give £3, as you're requested to, then you're instantly on somebody's database as somebody with a soft spot for puppies. So they're basically using the same kind of tools and techniques as any other advertiser.
Does that mean that chuggers, as they're called, the teenagers in tabards who just try and make contact with you on shopping precincts, are they outmoded already? Is there a chance that they could be phased out? Because, frankly, I will text puppy every 5 minutes. And are the charities themselves using the data in a different way to achieve their aims as well?
Well, yes. I suppose this is the good news, is that once they've got money, then they can use the data to make their work more effective. There are apps so that people who are hit by an earthquake can use their smartphones to take a picture of where a building has collapsed and geotag it, and it will be uploaded to some map so some aid agency can come in, and now they have a digital map that shows what the damage is and where the damage is, and they can go to where the need is greatest. Or people can put requests in for particular types of aid. You know, we need blankets, we don't need food. So that does make what they're doing more effective. But if you're thinking more in terms of big-scale philanthropy, of course, people are starting to now say, well, we don't want to just give a chunk of money to something that will have our name on. We actually want to know that it's doing some good, and we want to know that it's being used efficiently.
This is what's called effective altruism.
Yeah, well, I think there's
draining all of the sort of, you know, human warmth out of the thing.
Well, yes, but if you're going to give $1 million, what do you want? Do you want to have a warm glow because there's a big project with your name on, or do you want it to have the maximum possible effect for $1 million?
Well, I know a lot of the sort of new breed of philanthropists, many of whom are under 30 and already got their first billion in the bank, and this is often off the back of social media and that kind of, you know, high-tech stuff. These people, they love disruption. This is their business model. They want to see huge impacts. And in the same way they go, what industry is old and tired and we can kick it over and it's rotten to the core, they have the same approach to charity.
Well, that can be a good thing and a bad thing. It can be a good thing because they may be going to say, people have been doing this stuff for years. They've been giving goats to African villages. Has anyone ever actually collected any data to see whether goats are a good thing? Or is it just driven by egotists who want to see Simon Evans shaved into the side of a goat in an African village, you know, for example? It's a good thing if they actually go out and say, let's test the old model of giving, let's test the old projects, are they having the effects we want? But if they just want to go and say, hey, this is rubbish, all the stuff you've been doing before, I'm going to do a big thing that will have a big impact, it may not be a positive impact. Sometimes aid actually disturbs the local economy. So you send loads of free food in. You think this is great. Who doesn't want free food? Well, the people who are trying to grow and sell food locally, they don't want free food. You've just put them out of business.
God, that's a thought, isn't it?
Yes, that's the problem.
Better to just stay at home and drink quietly in front of the telly and keep your head down.
This is where data can be really useful because people are now starting to do randomised controlled trials. So like you would do with a drug, say, is the new drug better than the old drug? They will go out and say, let's take some similar villages. Half of them we will give the new drug or the new school or whatever the great project is, half of them we won't, and then we can actually see what the impact is maybe 5 years down the line.
And maybe the goats could have wearables as well.
Yeah, goat tagging. Now there's a...
I mean, I remember I bought my mother... I was going to say, it's hard to express this. I basically bought her a child. The child...
The child lived in Nepal. She had one in Africa for a while, and when it grew up, she asked me if I could get her one from a colder country next time because she likes to knit. This is true. And then every so often the child grows up and moves on and a new set of documents are sent to her. It's a bit like being an assassin, you know, you get this... You get, like, a dossier arrives in the post, you know, your new target. Now, that is efficient in one extraordinarily important respect, I think, which is that she's been made incredibly happy by it. These children may be fictitious, for all I know. I mean, I'm not saying the money is squandered in some money laundering scheme. I'm sure that it's going to a good cause, but I think basically they spend it on sanitation and drainage and schools and so on, rather than just making one child in the village preposterously wealthy and... knit and rich, you know, that would be... I think that would cause more trouble than it solved. But do you think the days of the old foundations, of the big Carnegie halls or whatever, that's still going to carry on? But the potential is there to just channel your money now in phenomenally well-tested, data-rich streams.
I think we probably will move towards that because, as you say, I think the younger generation of billionaires do tend to think less in terms of I'll have one building my name on and more... I mean, in a way, they're more ambitious. They think, oh, we're going to eradicate all disease or we're going to get rid of all malaria or every child will have a laptop with our brand on the back or whatever it is, which in a way is more ambitious. But in another way, probably also has a bigger long-term effect on the whole of
history. And given that Mark Zuckerberg is going to be president by 2023, he doesn't really need a library, does he? So, Tamandra, thank you. Tamandra Harkness. So there we have it. It does seem as though effective altruism or giving with precision is easier than ever. In conclusion, we may still idly wonder whether a little more scrutiny and oversight when it comes to philanthropy mightn't be a good thing, but given how hard we find it to regulate the banks when they're on a determined trajectory towards destroying civilization on a 9-yearly cycle, it's probably not going to be very easy or profitable to stop people giving their own money away. So, what have we learned? Bill Gates gives away billions every year, but none of it makes up for that little paperclip. Ticking the gift aid box can be morally problematic, especially when you're donating to ISIS. One theory as to why people give to charity is the warm glow theory, which describes the feeling you get when you lure a chugger down a dark alley and push them into a canal. This has been Simon Evans, Goes to Market. Good night! You've been listening to Simon Evans Goes to Market with me, Simon Evans, Tim Harford, Merrin Somerset-Webb and Tamandra Harkness. The show was written by me with Benjamin Partridge, the researcher was Andrew Wright and the producer was Richard Morris. It was a BBC Studios production.